Okay, good evening or morning or afternoon, wherever you are. I'm sorry that the webcam video seems to be on the fritz tonight. We tried to restart several times, but it didn't seem to work. So we're going to go without web video today, so you don't get to see my disembodied head tonight. Tonight we're going to talk about human rights and economic liberalization or economic freedom. This is a fun little project that I did with Art Cardin. Art is a professor at Rose College in Memphis, Tennessee. He's a friend of the Mises Institute. He actually, I believe, did one of these courses for the Mises Academy last year. And Art and I collaborated on this project, which led to a publication in a journal called Business and Politics. And I believe the formal publication is on your reading list. The topic really, the motivation for this, actually, let me tell the backstory for this, is that somebody for a journal, it was the Journal of Lutheran Ethics, and I used to teach at a university that had a Lutheran affiliation, and this Journal of Lutheran Ethics had an editor who was pretty friendly to free markets, and this editor found out that I was at one of his Lutheran universities, and so he asked me to write an article for him, and I did, and I wrote another article for him. And then he asked me, after I'd written a few articles for him, he asked me to write a review of Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine. The subtitle is The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. At that time, I was a little bit busy and was not that interested in having another article in the Journal of Lutheran Ethics, which you can imagine is not a very high-profile journal. So I called Art. Art's a young economist at the time. He's still young. He's in his 20s. And I said, Art, why don't you read this book and do the review, and you can get a publication out of it. And Art said, well, that's great. I'm actually already reading the book. And said, I'm going to be happy to do a review. So he did the review. And then after he did the review, which was not a favorable review, you can imagine, he came back to me and said, Bob, this book has got a lot of things in it that we could test. So we sat down to review her book, The Shock Doctrine, trying to figure out if there was anything we could do to empirically look at the claims she's making. So anyway, the article we ended up coming with was this book, article in Business and Politics. It appeared last year. The book is called, she wrote, called The Shock Doctrine, and there's a picture of her right there. She's quite a fetching young lady, if I may say so. And her thesis on disaster capitalism, I could describe it, and I was prepared to describe it, but thankfully we have this video thing. So hopefully you all have on the bottom right-hand side of your WebEx Event Center screen there something called Media Viewer, and I've loaded up a YouTube video. It's about 8 minutes long, a little over 8 minutes long, and I think it's best to let her do a little bit of talking here. So when I say go, not yet, how about everybody go ahead and click the little forward button. It's the button right there. You can see the forward button, just like you normally have on YouTube videos. Everybody's in complete control of their own video there, though. So if we all hit go about the same time, we'll all end about the same time. Okay? So how about we go 3, 2, 1, go.
I got really interested in the idea of shock and its use as a political tool when I was in Iraq covering the occupation, because there was almost a triple storm of shock. was referring to economic crises. And economic crises have played that role of sort of softening the ground for the imposition of shock therapy. The Asian economic crisis was a classic example. The so-called tequila crisis in Mexico was another one that unleashed a wave of privatization in Mexico. But as people become more resistant and more aware of these strategies, and you see these mass mobilizations against the institutions that exploited shock, like the International Monetary Fund, then what starts to happen is the shocks need to get bigger in order for the disorientation to be greater. And that's where you have what I call disaster capitalism. What the Bush administration did after the war, when the war on terror was declared, is they essentially launched a new economy, because the parameters of this economy were extraordinarily wide. This is an endless war, we're told. The enemy could not be reasoned with, there could be no diplomacy, there could be no discussion, there could only be attack. And that it would not end until people were right. So if you think of it as a business plan, it could hardly be more profitable. Basically what you're saying is we've got this new market, it's never going to end, and we have unlimited funds to finance this new market. So unlike a one-off war, what they were building was a permanent new part of the economy a privatized security state. One other thing Milton Friedman said is that after the crisis hit, the kind of change will depend on the ideas that are lying around. And that's really what the University of Chicago Economics Department was producing all of those years, were ideas that were lying around when the next crisis came, being prepared for that crisis. And so it's not a question of, we don't need some vast conspiracy to say, that these crises are being deliberately planned and created so that they can be exploited. So certainly there are some cases of
Okay, hopefully you all are pretty close to finish there. I'm going to go on in a minute and assume you all are finished with that wonderful talk by Naomi Klein. You know, there's so much there in that 8 minutes and 38 seconds that makes my blood want to boil, and maybe yours as well. But I want to focus in on just a few points. So basically, Naomi Klein is making an argument here, which is fundamentally an empirical argument. And her empirical argument is that free marketers have used crisis. And the exact quote from her video there was, "The exploitation of crisis and stock has consciously been used by radical free marketers." And she quotes Friedman. Friedman, of course, did those quotes are not taken out of context. He did say, in fact, that reform frequently occurs in the context of a crisis, and that when a crisis occurs, that in fact people look to the ideas that are lying about for the solution to the crisis. And so when a crisis occurs, the ideas that are laying around are the ideas that people will latch onto to solve the crisis. Those are true quotes from Friedman, and I think they make perfect sense. She does say in passing in the little video there and in the book that, well, this is not a conspiracy, but then she goes on to talk about how it is a conspiracy. She really does fundamentally believe that free market advocates, like those of us at the Mises Institute or Milton Friedman, in fact, have intentionally created or intentionally at least applauded crises. And she uses Chile as her primary example, and I'll come back to Chile a little bit at the end of today's talk, but Chile is her sort of example. And I hope that you listen carefully to the language she used. She said words like torture, and this is a quote, "torture and other forms of extreme violence." That's a direct quote. She said that the triumph of the free market around the world in the 80s and 90s, she said that the opposition to this was blasted out of the way. And at the very end of that video, she said what? She said this was a war, not a war of ideas, but a real war with real casualties. So one of the things I want to, before I go on, I want to sort of impress upon you is that I am not making this up. Naomi Klein quite genuinely is arguing that economic liberalization, that movements towards what she calls radical free markets, has taken place in the context of torture and violence, and that Milton Friedman and I suppose me and maybe all of you and the folks at the Mises Institute, that we not only were we just sort of on the sidelines applauding this these acts of torture and extreme violence, that we were complicit, that we in fact were involved in this experience. Now I must say before I go on, this pisses me off. This really, the more I thought about it, the more I've seen this video many more times than I care to admit, and each time I get more and more angry. I consider myself a radical free marketer. And Naomi Klein is accusing me and people like me of being torturers, or at least complicit with torture. Yeah, my video is not working tonight, so yeah, there you go. So what are we to make of this? Well, I think there's two ways in which we can respond to Naomi Klein. And this is a sort of closed audience at the Mises Academy, and I think I can say it. She's bat crazy. She's nuts. She is insane. But she's extremely articulate. She has incredible following. Please Google her name. She's all over the place. She's, Ivy League education. And I think that rather, my instinct is just to call her a bat crazy lunatic and ignore her. My other instinct is to engage her in an ideological debate. She's clearly wrong about the nature of capitalism. She's clearly wrong about the nature of progressive socialism. And we could try that. But you know what? I think that maybe, at least in this case, we don't have to do that. The best argument or against Naomi Klein would maybe just be to say, you know what? You're just wrong. She's not wrong about everything, though. In fact, she's correct about one thing. In fact, in the 1980s, in the 1990s, there was a triumph. I wouldn't call it a triumph of free market capitalism, but there was certainly a triumph in the direction of freer markets. This is unambiguously true. Now, those of us who are hardcore free marketers, maybe we don't think the triumph was complete, but there's unambiguous evidence from the Economic Freedom of the World Index that from the 1980s into the 1990s, we saw a wave of liberalization around the world. We saw lower tariffs around the world. We saw lower marginal tax rates around the world. We saw waves of privatization. We saw the breakup of the Soviet Union, which was a massive improvement in the lives of millions and millions and millions of people. So Naomi Klein is 100% correct when she mentions or she says that the 1980s and the 1990s was a period in which Milton Friedman's ideas were on the ascendancy. Andre Schleifer wrote an article in the Journal of Economic Literature last year called The Age of Milton Friedman, in which he recounted how Milton Friedman and his ideas, and I mean, it's not just Milton, it could be Murray Rothbard for that matter, but the ideas of free marketers in general took over in the 1980s and 1990s. Now, none of us were pleased with the final results because we still see a lot of problems, but there's no question we had incredible movement toward freer markets in the 1980s and the 1990s. The problem is not her recognition that freer markets were on the ascendancy. The problem I have is she attributes this change to crisis and torture and things like this. Let me try to move forward. I'm sorry, I'm a little confused here tonight. Okay, there we go. So let me talk a little bit more about the book. I want to focus in on Milton Friedman for a second. Milton was, of course, no anarcho-capitalist, but let's be fair. The world would be better off if we had more economists like Milton Friedman rather than fewer. And she lasers in on him as being a real complicit person. And so we see Milton's picture here, and that's Augustus Pinochet there on the bottom right. And if you look under Milton Friedman's heading in the index of Naomi Klein's book, Disaster Capitalism, you see a lot of references to Milton Friedman. In fact, this entire list here is references to Milton Friedman. Let's see. This is the one I like you to look at. It says right there, it may be difficult to read on your screen, but under the heading for Milton Friedman, it says, his responsibility for human rights violations, page 122, page 146 to 144 to 146, page 240 and page 345. So she is making explicit claims that Milton Friedman is complicit. He's responsible, literally the word is responsible, for human rights violations. Over in under Augusto Pinochet's index, you see advised by Milton Friedman as economy worsens, page 95 to 99. So she's trying to make a very explicit link between Milton Friedman on the one hand and Augusto Pinochet on the other. And she does this mostly by implication. So I want to talk a little bit about that later on, but I wanted to mention that at the outset. Okay. But let me just sort of go back and ask or try to frame the question. Naomi Klein says, economic liberalization, the movements towards freer markets, has taken place with the assistance of torture and other extreme forms of violence. It's a literal quote. The question I have is that true? Is it in fact the case? This is testable. We have evidence. We have knowledge. We have data on the degree of economic liberalization. We have knowledge and data on the degree of torture around the world. Is it in fact true? I'm going to leave ideology aside for a second. Is it literally the case that she's right on the data? And that's what I wanted to set out, and that's what Art Carden and I set out to do in this paper. So we wanted to set out to create an empirical model of Naomi Klein's disaster capitalism, and it's a very straightforward model. Basically she's saying is that economic freedom, economic liberalization, now she doesn't like economic liberalization, but economic freedom, which means lower taxes, privatization, lower regulations, freer trade, things she doesn't like, that economic freedom at any point in time, relative to what? Relative to economic freedom in a previous time. So it's I is the country, T minus one. So this first part is basically saying, what is economic freedom in a country today relative to what it was yesterday? What we're getting here with this equation is economic liberalization. And then we add into that human rights violations. Naomi Klein is saying that economic freedom in a particular country, after controlling for previous economic freedom, should grow if we have human rights violations. It's a straightforward, no, you know, bones about it, not a very difficult empirical claim, and it's testable. All right. So the question is, do countries that have human rights violations have growing economic freedom or not? We can test this. Before I go on, let me just sort of describe the data we have. Of course, economic freedom is the measure. It's Economic Freedom of the World Index. And you can see the data here. We actually have 700 observations. This is a panel. We have data for well over 100 countries for something like seven time periods, 1970, 1975, 1980, all the way forward. And so we have a lot of data on a lot of different countries. We also have data on all kinds of human rights violations. Now, this comes to us from a group called CIRI. It's C-I-R-I. If you Google it, it's C-I-R-I. Honestly, at the moment, I forget what it stands for. It's an index of human rights violations. And they have indexes of, for example, they have an index on disappearances. It's a very simple index. It's a 0, it's a 1, or it's a 2. And they have an index of extrajudicial killing. It's a 0, 1, or 2. They have an index of political imprisonment, which is just a 0, also a 0, 1, or 2. They have an index of torture, 0, 1, or 2. They also have something called assassination, 0, 1, or 2. Restrictions on freedom of speech, 0, 1, or 2. They have women's rights, 0, 1, 2, and 3. It goes up to 3 on that index. So they have all of these different indexes of human rights. And this is not a group of hardcore libertarians. This is not the Mises Institute putting together these. These are left-wing people who do studies of torture and political imprisonment, freedom of religion and workers' rights and so forth. Ah, yes. Singularly. CIRI stands for the authors. That's right. So that's why I can't remember it, because it's a couple of authors who I don't know. So we have the Economic Freedom Index, which measures the degree of liberalization in the economy. And then we have all these measures of, we have all these measures down here of torture and assassination and workers' rights and all these things that Naomi Klein and the left thinks those as being human rights. And they are. I mean, you know, torturing people is a violation of their human rights. So that's the data that we use. And this data set here is well used. They have, actually, I think they have data back to 1980. So unfortunately, our data set won't include the Allende period in Chile, but we've got data for 30 years now, or 20 years, 30 years really. And we have a lot of evidence from all of these countries all around the world about the degree of liberalization, the amount of tortures and assassinations and such around these places. And she's claiming that economic freedom of the world, the economic freedom index, should be growing in those places that have more torture and more assassinations and more restrictions on elections and weaker women's rights and so on. That's her claim. And that's really hard to see. So let me apologize. That's really hard to see. Hopefully you can see that. I don't know if you can blow that up or not. Doesn't look like you can, at least not on TV. But you'll have to take it from me here. Every one of these, no matter which specification we use, every approach that we use, this one right here, assassinations, that's disappearances, restricted elections, something called empowerment rights, extrajudicial killing, freedom of movement, right? Every one of these coefficients is positive, 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 positive. Literally everyone. That one's negative, but it's not significant. Every one of these is positive. The ones that are significant, that's what the stars are for, those are positive. In literally every case, each of these regressions, that's a regression, that's a regression, that's one. So there's like 42 regressions here. 42 different regressions here. And literally every regression, every way in which we could figure out to compare economic liberalization on the one hand and the degree of human rights violations on the other, in every case, we find that human rights violations actually corresponded to less liberalization. Exactly the opposite of what Naomi Klein claimed. Naomi Klein claimed that torture, disappearances, assassinations, extrajudicial killings, whatever you want to call these things, that these things occurred to foster economic liberalization. What our results show is exactly the opposite, that in fact places that had more torture had less liberalization, not more. Places that had assassinations and disappearances and so forth had less liberalization, not more. So this is more. Here's the one, torture. I love the one on torture. She literally uses the word torture over and over again in the book and in her video. She says torture. And that's not a weak word. That's not a word you use casually, at least in my opinion. That's a strong word. She claimed explicitly that Milton Friedman, free marketers, you and me perhaps, that we have used torture, we and our, you know, people, whoever they are, have used torture to foster liberalization all around the world, and that the worldwide improvement in economic liberty that occurred in the 1980s and 1990s occurred in the context of torture. Well, that coefficient's positive. That's the wrong sign for her. It's the right sign for us. That positive sign means that places that had less torture had more liberalization. So, the lesson that I have from this paper, and the lesson I'd like to impart upon you as a teacher here, I guess, is that when you encounter a Naomi Klein, when you encounter a progressive, it is so very, very tempting to want to engage them into an immediate ideological debate. But if you've watched that video, I mean, seriously, ask yourself, what are the odds that anything we say to Naomi Klein is going to convince her that economic liberalization is a good idea? She is convinced that socialism, progressive leftism, socialism, whatever you want to call it, is a good idea. And no amount of argument, at least in my opinion, no amount of argument is going to convince her. But Maybe nothing will convince her, but at least for the people that read Noemi Klein who are persuaded by her, I'm somewhat persuaded that, yes, we can engage them in an ideological argument about why they're wrong about the nature of markets, the nature of socialism, and so forth, but the data, a data-based argument seems to be more persuasive. Again, she argues that economic liberalization has taken place around the world because of torture, because of violence, because of violations of human rights. And that is simply not backed up by the data. It seems to me it throws her entire thesis into a tailspin when you confront her with the with the facts. Okay? So I have nothing against an ideological argument with an opponent, but I also think that we should, as people who are friendly to free markets, that we should engage our opposition not just with ideological arguments, but with factual arguments. They're making factual claims all the time, and those factual claims frequently are not true. Her factual claim in this book is that economic liberalization requires torture, and it's not true. In fact, it's the opposite. Economic liberalization occurs more or often with less torture. So that's the lesson of the day. Before I sort of finish, and we're going to have plenty of time for questions today. This is a relatively short presentation, so there'll be plenty of time for questions, and I'll stay around for the usual time. But I do want to backtrack a little bit and talk about Milton Friedman and Chile, because her main piece of evidence, well, she talked a lot about Iraq as well, but her main piece of evidence in favor of her thesis is Chile. And let me talk a little bit about Chile. As many of you know, Salvador Allende was elected, and he was a socialist. He was a Marxist, and it's not me calling him a Marxist. He called himself a Marxist. He was a self-acknowledged Marxist. Salvador Allende ran for president of Chile in the beginning of the 1970s. I figured it was 70 or 71, and he won. In fact, Allende, to his credit, I suppose, has the, to my knowledge, he is the only avowedly Marxist head of state to ever win a fair election, at least by widely agreed to be a fair election. There's little doubt that, oh, that's funny, Daniel, thank you, that's hilarious, I'm laughing. I should stop looking at the chat, though, because it's distracting. Obama doesn't call himself a Marxist, so I'm still correct. Allende called himself a Marxist. He ran for office, and he actually won, even though he called himself a Marxist. So what happened in Allende's first year and a half in office? Well, he did what Marxists do. He began to nationalize industries like crazy. He began to initiate a whole series of presidential office regulations and edicts. And on the picture you see here, if you haven't seen this picture, it's quite awesome. This is an actual picture. This is not the Star Trek Enterprise. It looks like Captain Kirk. This looks like Captain Kirk's seat, right? This is not the Enterprise, or this is not Star Trek. This is Salvador Allende's command center for the Chilean economy. I'm not making this up. This picture is a picture of what in Santiago, Chile, of a command center room in which the Allende government planned to run the Chilean economy. And I don't know if Allende was going to sit here and he was going to push these buttons and orders would go out. By the way, it's all fake. It's very much like the Star Trek Enterprise in this sense. It's all fake. All of these screens, all of these things around the room are actually fake because they didn't have the technology in 1971 or 72 to do this. But Salvador Allende was no joke of a Marxist. He was quite seriously a hardcore central planning Soviet-style Marxist, best friends with Castro and the whole thing. And he planned to create a centrally planned economy of this sort. And from the very beginning, the edicts went out. Now, this room was really just a mock-up, a prototype. But it gives you an indication of what Allende was all about. It's sadly the case that this room was destroyed. So we only have a few pictures of it remaining. But I do think that someone in some museum somewhere should recreate this and put it in a museum. So Allende was elected president of Chile. He starts nationalizing industries. Production, of course, immediately grinds to a halt. Inflation, because tax revenues were down, they started printing money like crazy. Inflation is out of control. And the economy is in a complete tailspin. And this is where one of the many things that Naomi Klein says in her book that is flat out wrong is she claims that it was the free market economists and Augusto Pinochet, who, of course, succeeded Allende, who destroyed the Chilean economy. In fact, it's completely clear, if you look at the data, that Chile was in a complete economic tailspin during Allende's office because of the nationalizations and the hyperinflation and ridiculous things like this room right here. So Allende is come into office. The economy goes into a complete mess. And depending on whose version of history you believe, it's unambiguously true. Allende was murdered. And it's probably the case that the U.S. government and CIA had a hand in that. But regardless, there was a military coup. Allende was murdered, and one of the generals who participated in that coup, General Augusto Pinochet, became the succeeder, the president of Chile. I don't have any more slides. But let me just talk a little bit about Pinochet. So Pinochet is a general, and Pinochet was not a nice man. But he's not a particularly ideological guy. He was a general. He participated in the coup, and he became the leader of the country. But he actually had very little knowledge of economics and was not particularly interested in economics. So he went to some economists in Chile who happened to be trained near Chicago. And it was true that they actually had a plan for reinvigorating the Chilean economy, and that plan was a market liberal plan. It was a plan that was much in line with that of Milton Friedman. Although Milton Friedman had little to do with these people, it was mostly a guy named Arnold Harburger, a colleague of Milton Friedman's at the University of Chicago. So Harburger students in Chile, they went to Pinochet went to them, and they said, look, the economy is in a mess, what should we do? And they went to him and said, look, we need to privatize the industries that were nationalized, we need to stop printing money, we need to reform Social Security. As most of you probably know, Chile privatized the Social Security program under these economists, most notably José Piñera, the Chilean economist. And so very quickly, the Chilean government under Pinochet began to institute a system of economic liberalization. It's not true that they created the crisis. The crisis was there under Allende, but they did take advantage of it. Naomi Klein is right about that. So the Chilean economists begin this, and of course what happens in Chile's economy begins to grow and rapidly, and everything's good, is fine. What was Milton Friedman's view and role in all this? Milton Friedman had almost nothing to do with any of this. In fact, the university in Santiago invited Milton down in the mid-1970s. He did go. He refused an honorary degree because he didn't want to have the appearance of supporting the administration. He did meet with Pinochet for exactly one half of an hour, and which he told him to, Pinochet asked him what he should do, and he said, cut government spending and don't print so much money. And that was the extent of Milton Friedman's involvement with Chile. So on the part of the left, on the part of the Naomi Kleins of the world, Milton Friedman's association with with Pinochet and with Chile has been exaggerated beyond all recognition. There's just no evidence that Milton Friedman had anything to do in a direct or really even in an indirect sense with the reforms in Chile. And yet she chose to use Friedman as her straw man to attack. You probably could use Arnold Harberger as a straw man, I suppose, more readily, but Milton was the one she chose to use. And I think it's unfair to Milton's legacy. Whatever Milton Friedman's legacy is going to be, it's completely unfair that many people are going to go down in history thinking that Milton Friedman had something to do with Augusto Pinochet. He really had little to do with anything there. Pinochet, of course, again, was not a nice guy. Several thousand people, there's a monument in Santiago to the well over 2,000 people who disappeared and by all accounts died under Pinochet's regime. He was not a nice guy. We should not applaud Pinochet. He was not a liberal in the correct sense of that word. But regardless, Allende was not a liberal either. Allende was a totalitarian Marxist. And Allende was putting that country into a real tailspin. Pinochet and the generals were authoritarian right-wingers. We happen to get lucky in the case of Pinochet that Pinochet, unlike most authoritarian right-wingers, was willing to let the economy liberalize. And what ended up happening at the end of the day, of course, in Chile is that some 20 years later, Pinochet lost power, and today we have a functioning liberal democracy that is in Chile, but also a functioning market economy. In the Economic Freedom of the World Index today, Chile is ranked 6th in the entire world. So again, just to let me recap, and then we'll open it up for questions. The moral of the story here is that when someone makes an empirical claim that economic liberalization requires torture, we can argue with her. We can simply say you're wrong, or in addition, and we should, you know, we have data on economic liberalization. We have data on torture. And we shouldn't let left-wingers like Naomi Klein make empirical claims that are just flat-out wrong. It's bad enough that their ideology is wrong, but their evidence is wrong, too. And evidence is pretty powerful here. These regressions that I've run, which I understand may be a little confusing, these regressions that we have in these tables are basically saying, in every case, that countries that had less human rights violations had more liberalization, which is 180 degrees opposite of what Naomi Klein said. So Naomi Klein is wrong. And it's not just that her ideology is wrong. She's factually wrong. And that's the moral of the story. So, well, that took me about 50 minutes. I think we have plenty of time for questions, if there are any. I can look at some of the chats. Again, from my point of view, it's distracting to look at the chats as they come across. So I can go back and look at some of these and maybe answer some questions. But let me look here. Steve, I'm going to just do this. When are we going to do YouTube rebuttal? You know, that's a great question. We probably should. Art Cardin sent Naomi Klein this article, and we didn't hear back from her, though, so I don't know. But Mark Trebach, don't let a crisis go to waste. I mean, this is something that both sides, we all agree. When there is a crisis, whether it's a war or an economic crisis, that is an opportunity for institutional change. And Milton Friedman is correct in saying that, and so is Obama's administration in saying that. Okay, and it's also true that the ideas that are around are the ideas that people will latch on to. There's nothing terrible about that. There's no conspiracy here. Steve Wise, way up at the in the middle there, you ask, what kind of coefficients did her regressions produce? That's a beautiful question, Steve. Well, that's exactly the point. She didn't run any regressions, did she? That's the exact point of this, really this entire session of lectures, is the power of large sample size. So often the left picks an example, an anecdote, a story, and that becomes the thing they use to generalize. So she picks Chile. And Chile, it's in fact true that in Chile there was some torture. I mean, it wasn't exactly, you know, Nazi Germany, but there was torture. Several thousand people are dead today because of Augusto Pinochet. We should not be applauding Augusto Pinochet. He's an evil man. But, and it's also, and it's true that the liberalization in Chile occurred during Augusto Pinochet's regime. But what is not true is that there's an analytical link between torture and economic liberalization. She chose one example, exactly the one example that fits her thesis, ignoring the other hundreds of samples. We have hundreds of countries in the world where we have data, and she ignores them all. So that's the point. She has no regressions. She has a couple anecdotes, and she wrote a whole damn book on it, forgive my language, and she is famous because she took a couple examples and was too, again, I'm going to say damn, she's too damn lazy to run a regression. So it really annoys me as a scholar of these things to see people making empirical claims based on one or two data points that they've cherry-picked. So that's she didn't run any regressions. The bottom line is there are no regressions in her book. Now, several people in the chat have commented on the U.S., and I'm gonna agree. The United States is clearly an outlier. In this whole story. The United States is a country that scores relatively high on the Economic Freedom Index and is a country that is particularly warlike. And this goes back to last week's talk where we talked a little bit about Eric Gartsky's work on economic freedom and war. And there was really a question on this. The United States is particularly, how should I say it, warlike. We engage in a lot of wars. And it's far more than you would expect based on our high degree of liberalization. Again, that's exactly the same problem. We are one country. There are hundreds of countries in the world. And we should not be making general arguments about the nature of free markets, the nature of free market capitalism, and warlikeness based on the United States or based on Chile. The general case, the general argument is really overwhelmingly powerful. Countries that are more market-oriented are less warlike, and they're less torturous and so on. So, yes, the United States is an outlier, but that doesn't disprove the general case. In fact, I would argue that you should not look at individual countries very often when we're making these kinds of arguments. Yeah, Mercy, you're right. We don't have a lot of assassinations and rejected elections, you're right. On this particular measure, we're pretty good. Mark Trebatch, you've actually had a couple of good questions today. You asked, would you view that FDR did shock therapy in the socialist sense? That's a beautiful question, and this is really, someone else mentioned Bob Higgs. You know, the opposite argument, the companion argument to Naomi Klein is Bob Higgs' argument in Crisis and Leviathan. Robert Higgs has argued that it's not economic liberalization that takes place in the context of crisis. It's the move towards socialism. And Robert Higgs, if you don't know Bob, Bob's a, you all know Bob. So Bob's work on Crisis and Leviathan, it was sort of the basis of my dissertation. His argument is that Naomi, is the exact opposite of Naomi Klein. Naomi Klein's argument is that economic liberalization requires human rights violations, violence, torture, and so on, crisis in general. Bob Higgs has the opposite viewpoint, that countries that move towards socialism use crisis to move towards socialism, and FDR is the greatest example. The Great Depression, of course, was a serious crisis. The Great Depression was used by the FDR administration as an excuse to move towards socialism. I don't think we moved to socialism. We certainly moved in that direction. And so I think that when you look at the evidence around the world, I think is much more consistent with Bob Higgs's story, that crises have been used more frequently to move towards economic repression, socialism, than the other way around, as Naomi Klein finds. There are so many questions and so many comments on the chat. It's very difficult for me to call through them. So I'm pretty much going to look at the bottom of the list. So if I haven't addressed your issue or your concern or your question, type it again so I can see it at the bottom, and then we'll go from there. That works too, Kevin. Thank you. Q&A works for questions, and chat works for yourselves. Either way, it works for me. Mercy asks at the top, will all of this be available for download? I mean, the paper that I have with Art, which has these tables and so forth, is in your... should be available to you. And if it's not, contact Danny Sanchez or myself. We'll make sure you get it. Not a problem. So Kevin McHale, you're asking me, could our money be the world reserve currency, allowing our deficit spending on a national level be responsible for our economy being better than it should be according to the formula? Honestly, that's not a question I have a strong viewpoint on. The fact of the matter is the U.S. dollar is the world's reserve currency, you know, for all intents and purposes. And I think to a certain extent that does give us some extra degree of latitude for deficit spending and debt than other countries would have. I mean, you can see what's happening in Greece. You can see countries like Greece whose debt to GDP ratios are not dramatically higher than that of the United States. It's much higher, but not dramatically higher. You see how quickly a country like Greece gets into deficit or gets into crisis because of its debt, where the United States seems to be less sensitive to that. So I think being the reserve currency, it gives us some insulation, but it's no protection from crisis. But to be perfectly honest, I don't think we have a lot of knowledge about the nature of these kinds of macroeconomic issues, and. So I'm not a macroeconomist. I'm a macroeconomist in the sense that I study long-run economic growth, but short-term crises type things related to, you know, debt crises and so forth. I don't have a lot to say. Okay, I'm going to answer these in turn. Brian asks, do I believe Ron Paul's mission is to make sure that his message is lying around during time of crisis? That's an interesting question. I imagine that's the case. I don't think there's any doubt that Ron Paul's moved the debate in a different direction. I mean, I don't think I'm Hopefully I'm not going to make anybody too angry when I say I don't think Ron Paul has a chance in hell of becoming president of the United States, and I don't think Ron Paul ever thought he had a chance of being president. I think that's an empirical reality. But I do think that, yeah, he's running for president this time, and as he did before, in order to move the debate, in order to make sure that these ideas that he has are there on the table and are somewhat respectable. And I think that that's a wonderful thing he's doing. For the record, I'd be happy to have him be president, but I just don't think it's very likely in the institutional context we have. Okay, another question. Mercy Bowyer. I don't understand the table. So the correlations you're seeing here, these are regression coefficients. That number right there is the regression coefficient between the number of assassinations and the amount of economic liberalization that's occurred. So the assassination scale, the higher the number means the less assassinations. So higher numbers are good here. So higher numbers of assassinate, kind of awkward, but the higher the value for this variable right here, it says that there's a positive relationship with economic freedom. So more less assassinations means more economic liberalization. So that's what these coefficients are telling us. The positive signs are telling us that better assassination records, meaning less assassination, correspond to more liberalization. It is a little bit awkward because the scale of the CRI, the CRI data, the scale are higher numbers indicate less bad results. So the positive signs here, though, are consistent with the story that fewer disappearances, fewer appearances, less restricted elections all correspond to more liberalization. And that's what these coefficients are saying. Okay, the only one that's negative, I think, is this one right here, and it's not statistically significant. Hope that helps. But these are all individual coefficients from a regression. So there are 42 regressions here. 1, 2, 3 times all of these. So there's a lot of regressions being run. We're reporting just the coefficient on single regressions there. The correlation is the very top number. Yeah, thanks. Let me see here. Greg, you're asking a question. I'm not sure I understand it. Only because we can print our own currency, their debt is different than their currency. That's the kiss of death. You're actually correct. I think I know what you mean there. That's a good point. The problem for Greece is, and this is the problem for the whole European Union, is they have engaged in a situation in which individual sovereign nations can run up debt like crazy, but they can't monetize it. So in the old world, the Greeks would run up debt like mad. They would then print drachma like crazy to inflate away the debt, and it was fine. That's how they did it. Everybody understood what Greece was all about. In today's world, with Greece being part of the euro, they can still run up their own sovereign debt, but they can't print money, at least not without the permission of the Germans and the French and so forth. And so that's certainly the reason for the crisis. This is analogous, though, to that of the states of the United States. The state of Texas can run debt, but the state of Texas cannot print debt, cannot print money. But it's well understood in the United States context that the federal government may print money to bail itself out, but the federal government is not going to print a lot of money to bail out West Virginia. So the states of the United States are a little bit more fiscally responsible because they don't think the federal government will bail them out, whereas the Greeks were fiscally irresponsible with the understanding or the expectation that the Euro, the ECB, would bail them out, and so far they've been correct, haven't they? I don't think I've got any more questions on the queue. I want to say that if you get the chance, and I know it may make you mad, but you can go on YouTube and look at Naomi Klein's video. Watch that video again. I mean, there is a lot of really, if you want to really see into the mind of the progressive left, what they're thinking, how they look at the world. That video is really instructive. I think it's fascinating to see that her worldview is so vastly different than mine, and probably yours. It's worth looking at. Every time I look at that video, I'm like, wow, I learned a little bit. Matthew, yes, there's no question that, like most people on the left, and most of the people that are protesting, you know, the Occupy Wall Street people and so forth we see in the news, there is absolutely no distinction in Naomi Klein's mind between authentic capitalism and what we would call crony capitalism. And to that extent, I think we can all agree, right? The capitalism that we see out there in the real world today, the capitalism that bails out Bear Stearns and General Motors, is not capitalism. We call it crony capitalism. They call it crony capitalism. I think where we disagree and where I think we're forever going to disagree is on where we should go from there. The Robert Lawson and Mises Institute answer to where we go from here is to move towards authentic capitalism. The capitalism based on private property, profit and loss, and bankruptcy for firms that make bad decisions. Naomi Klein's and her side of the world is to move in the direction of socialism, so that rather than let us have private property and authentic capitalism, we would have some sort of social bailout for everybody, not just the businesses. So no, Naomi Klein is completely tone deaf to that distinction, and that's true of most people on her side of the aisle. Yeah, some of you are debating whether you should thumbs up or thumbs down the video. Oh, go ahead, thumbs down it or thumbs up it. I don't care. To me, it's such an absurd video on its face. I mean, I looked at some of the comments and some people liked it, but to me, it's such an absurd video on its face that the more people that watch it, the more I fear we're going to be better off. I mean, it's really quite ridiculous. I would be happy to see everybody. I would be happy if everybody in the world saw that video. Daniel, I hope you're right. That's all I can say. I voted for Ron Paul when he ran for party as a libertarian, and I guess I'd vote for him again if I voted. But so there you go. Voted for McCain. Okay. So I'm afraid this is a relatively short presentation. Are there any more questions? Okay, Mark, which one was that? Sorry. Is it okay, Mark? Are you asking about the one where you say this, should the United States government attempt to protect citizens' property in other countries? Is that the question? Okay, that's a deep question, buddy. And I don't honestly. I'm not smart enough to answer that question. I'll be honest with you. And my own view. I've said this in public, and I've said this in public forums that are way less friendly than you all are. I'll be blunt. I think it was absolutely 100% unambiguously a good thing that Allende left this earth when he did. That guy was bad. He was evil. He was wrong. And Allende's solutions or Allende's ideas for the country of Chile would have killed many, many, many more people than Augusto Pinochet. Now, that's what I believe. Pinochet is, Allende is a bad guy. Pinochet is a bad guy. And I'm completely 100% comfortable saying Allende was a worse bad guy than Pinochet. Now, the question of whether or not the U.S. government should have participated in upsetting Allende or killing him and removing him, his regime, I pretty much am against that. Pretty much against that. I don't shed any tears for Salvador Allende. I don't shed any tears for Saddam Hussein. He was a bad guy too. So I don't shed any tears for Saddam Hussein. I don't shed any tears for Salvador Allende. But I don't think the United States government has the right as a government, the government, quad government. I don't think they have the right to do that. And I'm opposed to that. But again, if I was a Chilean citizen, that was a man on the street in Chile, it is unambiguously my opinion that that country is better off for having gotten rid of Allende, even though they had to suffer under a kind of a tin pot dictator like Pinochet for a generation or so. Allende was far worse. I don't think the U.S. government, in fact, I don't think the U.S. government needed to do it. The Chilean government would probably have taken care of it on their own, but that's another story. So it's complicated. It's complicated. Yeah, I think the U.S. was wrong to take out Saddam Hussein. And I think we were wrong to get rid of Allende. But given that we did that, it was a good thing. I mean, really, there's no question in my mind, Chile's better off today. If Chile hadn't gotten rid of Allende, they probably would be Cuba today. Daniel, I think you raised an excellent question there. Has freedom gone up in Iraq? I don't know. Time will tell. I know it went up in Chile. I have no doubt what happened there. But these cases are different. And I don't think the track record of the United States is all that positive. So I don't think it's generalizable. That's why I'm against U.S. intervention in foreign countries, is because I don't think that the Chilean experience is representative. I think more often than not, when we've interfered in other countries, we've gotten bad results, not good results. So that's why I'm against it. Mark asks, are there global public goods that America provides that may enhance global economic freedom while decreasing it at home? That's an empirical question, right? I mean, that's not an ideological question. The question is, are the things that we do, when you say global public goods, I'm thinking you're assuming our projection of military power. Sea lanes, yes, absolutely. That's an empirical question. I don't have a strong view on it. I tend to wait. In my own case, I tend to wait until I've got data before I make judgment calls on these kind of things. My guess, frankly, is no. My guess, quite frankly, is that the projection of military power and the protection of sea lanes and such is something that the United States has a very small impact on. And so I don't, you know, there's all kinds of work that's been done on private, one of my teachers was Bruce Benson at Florida State University, one of my mentors, and his whole work on the law merchant and the ability of private people to manage the global commons without states. So I'm persuaded a little bit by that. And then even if it's true that there are certain good that comes from the United States, governing the world, such as protecting sea lanes, you have to weigh that against the bat. I mean, you have to weigh that against the fact the U.S. government has killed, in the last decade, hundreds of thousands of human beings. I mean, even if you're just a cold, hard calculus, you have to weigh all this against each other. So my gut instinct is no, but that's an empirical question. I'd like to see, kind of an empirical answer. I don't have one, though, so that's why I'm kind of stumbling around. Thank you for saying that, Mark. That is, in fact, my mantra here, is wait for facts. Okay, well, it's 9:16. I think we can have maybe one or two more questions, but it's 9:16 where I am. I don't know where you are, but it's getting close to my time to go. Okay, it's 10:15. You're in Eastern time. Well, it looks like we're out of time and questions, so I want to thank everybody for your attention. I realize it was a little bit of a short presentation, maybe a little bit more confusing than the other ones that we've had. Next week's, I hope, will be a little bit more straightforward, and it actually has to do with Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek's views on the relationship between economic freedom and political freedom, which are quite subtle, and I think one of my favorite papers, one of my favorite ideas I've ever come up with is the one we'll talk about next week. So I look forward to seeing you all then. Thanks.